I'd like to call the Transportation Finance and Policy Division to order. Today, basically, we want to bring people up and let them know what's happening with some of the issues, because we think there's probably some legislation dealing with part of the agenda that we have. Can you hear me way back up there? It's coming through? Okay. The agenda addresses some items that we think will be addressed by legislation or may need legislation, and that's the reason we're going to go ahead to get some members some opportunity to be aware of what's going on. And also, if you look at the committee, we've got a name change. If you don't see, it's Bryduck instead of Man. Young lady got married, her name is Mrs. Bryduck. No, it's wrong. Anyhow, we have some members that are excused, and I think, do we have a quorum, Susie, or not? Wait, we may not have a quorum yet, do we?
3, 6, 10, 11, 12.
We need one. We don't have a quorum, but we'll start on our agenda. And the first person to testify is Deputy Commissioner Mr. Sejum. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sejum. And he's going to speak, along with others, I believe, on the public-private partnerships. And the reason he's coming in, if you remember, in the last month or 6 weeks, I think we've had some media attention to the fact that there were some projects that were advanced with the public-private partnership agreements, which is not new, but it's relatively an advance prior to what we've done before that much, 2003, anyhow. Mr. Sejum.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We do have, I believe we have three subjects that we're going to talk to you about today. One is the public-private partnership that you mentioned. We also will talk about design-build projects, where we've been and where we're going with it, as far as projects go. And then also local bridges, which Rick Stonis is here to talk to you about then. Getting back to the public-private partnership, as you know, the department, by the way, I only have this one slide, the top part that says introduction, that's all I'm doing. The rest of it, Brad will take care of. I'll do the first bullet. our strategic directions within the department is safety, mobility, innovation, leadership, and transparency. And the middle one, innovation, is one that we take very seriously. Of course, every administration always talks about innovation. Administrations in the future will also do that. What we've done is we're truly committed to it, and with respect to innovative finance, we created an office last year when we came on board. And Brad Larson is the office director for that, and you'll hear from him later. A few weeks ago, the commissioner and the governor had a press conference to announce some initiatives that we have. One of them is the innovative financing and public-private partnership. Basically, what we see that as being is leveraging other dollars, and the benefits can be twofold: advancing projects when there's not enough state trunk highway dollars, public dollars there may be a willing public agency that might be interested in helping advance that. So advancing projects, and the other part is the whole economic development discussion, especially the last couple of years. We see ourselves at the DOT as a biggest part of our job, of course, is fixed potholes and fixed bridges and so on. That's our bread and butter. But that's not the only thing. We see ourselves that we can be a part of the solution. It's going to take a lot to help the economic situation, but we see ourselves that we can help businesses start up and communities bring in high-paying jobs in the communities and so on. so that was one item that was discussed, and there was a couple of examples of projects. One project that was advanced, as you mentioned. Another initiative that was discussed by the governor and commissioner was the MNPAS study, the second phase of the MNPAS study. And we've done a couple of those, as you know, one on 394 and one as part of the urban partnership agreement from Lakeville up to downtown. And the goal with this one is to come up with the next MNPAS program, next corridor. So look at our so we're looking to bring in our consultant to do that and help us with we're coming up with another route. Another initiative was question.
I was going to say too, are you going to, excuse me just a minute, are you going to identify some of those projects before you finish, the ones that you were talking about now?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, I can.
Representative Hausman?
On those MNPAS, if it's comparable to what the Urban Partnership Agreement was, are we going to wait, though, to see whether that thing is even going to work? I mean, we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars, and that might be very expensive bus service, unless we see evidence that all of that local conflict can be worked out and that we can actually get bus rapid transit. Mm-hmm. I would hope that we wait to see whether something like that is going to actually work the way we had envisioned.
Mr. Sehigem?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, you're right. I think that's a very good point. With the 394 corridor, I think it's been working, it's been paying for itself and helping utilize the capacity that's sitting there. And the 35, that's just started, and it's hard to even judge that because the big chunk of it in the middle, the Crosstown project, is not done yet. So it's hard to say if it's doing anything as far as congestion relief or anything like that. What we have here is to look at, to basically study it, and our deadline is September, so to look at where other areas may be that we can, where the next projects could be that would be viable. And then, of course, the next step of the discussion is to see if you want to go forward and what you, if it's cost beneficial to do that. So,
that'll be part of addressing your question.
Yes, I just coincidentally was down in Apple Valley this morning for a town hall meeting, and local representatives were clearly talking about that. Is if we get all these things worked out, and I mean clearly there's just a lot of work that still has to go on.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And you know, along these same lines, you had mentioned that you don't have conclusive data, or you can't really move forward even with any kind of anecdotal analysis of what's happening on 35W with that project. You know, it has been 2.5 months, and so I'm just wondering if, you know, again, knowing that it's very preliminary, can you at least give us a sense of, you know, how things are going from what you can tell? Again, it's, you know, I hear mixed things. So from your perspective, how are things going first 2.5 months?
Mr. Sehigem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, from our perspective, I think the numbers that I have heard, we have 5,200 transponders out there, maybe 4,200. I better make sure. I think it's 4,200, and it's averaging about $5,500 a day as far as the dollars go. And the congestion relief part of it, I think it's really hard to judge whether it has been able to take enough single occupants from the general purpose lane to the HOV hot lane to declare victory at this time, and it's way too early to do that. Again, that's because of the Crosstown project, because you might get a relief up to that point, and then they have to go back with everybody else doing construction and then back again. So we're not able to judge that at this time. So it may be a while before we can do that. But as far as selling transponders, I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but what I've heard was as far as selling transponders and people joining the program, it's pretty comparable to 394, and it's what we have expected.
Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you have any preliminary data on transit ridership in the corridor since the ribbon was cut, as it were, in September?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, may I continue?
Yes. Another project that we talked about was the 94 managed lane project. And that is between the two downtowns. If you remember, when the bridge collapsed, we took a bus shoulder and converted it to a lane, opened it up. It was very, it was a smart thing to do. It created capacity, of course, and the people who drive cars really liked it. And I don't think it impacted the transit as much, except for when there was days when there was a severe snowstorm where the buses were stuck. But when we built the bridge, then we had to make a decision, and this, we decided to do a study, and that's what we're going to, based on that study, we have a couple of projects that's proposed here that's going to be a win-win for both transit and a car riders in that area. It will be a, we'll have some technology in that. I don't have all the presentations here, of course, but we can always do that if you'd like. Different technologies that will help manage the traffic through the corridor of 94. You know, you have a log jam at Minneapolis at the tunnel and the Spaghetti Junction, the same thing. So how do you manage that between the two? Then we also have some, the other announcement that was made was low-cost, high-benefit projects within the metro area, taking $20 to $40 million of bond dollars to come up with high-impact projects. You've seen some of them around the city, and that's our goal. These are projects to do $5 to $10 million that's going to relieve congestion. And then for rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota, we have some safety proposals as far as, I think we're talking about putting reflective, wet reflective paint tape on our, about 1,000 miles of our system divided up amongst the districts, and this is the type of pavement marking that you'll be able to see when it's raining and in the dark. It's a high-tech application. So with that, I'd like to just reiterate that public-private partnership, I see it as being a tool for us to be able to bring in additional dollars, willing investors who want to invest in the system. That will benefit our system, it will benefit the local system and the community by creating jobs. And it will accelerate projects and help with the economic development of the state. We do have some, well, one thing I wanted to say before I move on, and Brad might want to talk about this, what we're talking about is not what happened in Indiana or in Chicago with the Chicago Skyway and the Indiana Toll Road, where they were selling assets, and that's not something we're interested in at all. So, but Brad has some examples of some projects. Maybe we want to, if you have questions for me, we can do that. Or Brad can, I'll stay here, and he can start talking about, he has like 7 or 8 slides that we can talk about.
Before you get into that, Mr. Seajan, did I catch all the projects that you announced here? The governor's initiative that you and the commissioner had a joint news conference saying which one they'd be. And the other question I have, there may be some other questions. When you, I think the consideration is not so much about selling our interstate like in Indiana or like you say in Illinois or Pennsylvania where it is, but when you have a public-private partnership, how much money do the privates put in to be considered a partnership and some of those things? I think those are questions that the committee would have.
Mr. Chair, the project that I, the one that was mentioned specifically was the 169 Bren Road interchange in Minnetonka. That is a project that has that has state dollars, our own dollars in it, which is part of it is the interchange program that was passed by the legislature. It was passed the past 2 years. You folks provided dollars to us to help build interchanges that are for safety and for economic development. So that's continuing that program. So some of the dollars came from that. And then, of course, United Health, on that specific project, United Health was willing to put up to $5 million into that project. And then we have BEAD, Department of Employment and Economic Development. They're partners with us. We've been working with them much, much closer than before. And all of these efforts that we have is with that department. And they have, I believe, between $1 to $2 million in that project. And we look to them to help us figure out what projects are truly economic development. Sometimes and we look at new high-paying jobs, bringing new companies in to the state. I think that's the big key. Just building a new Home Depot in this corner may not be that. That's the debate between the economists, and they talk about maybe that'll just transfer jobs from one neighborhood to another. Is that an addition to the state? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. So we're cautious about that. So that was one example. Another one that was mentioned in the commissioner and the governor's press conference was the Elk Run project down in District 6. And that one, was the $13 million worth of donation that the property donation that the developer had purchased toward the project. So that was another project that was discussed. So that's all I can think of. And there may be more in Brad's presentation that we can talk about.
Any questions for the committee relating to these specific types? And again, I think the question that I would specifically have in the future is how you determine what's the amount a private would put in. And that's, I know it's sensitive, each one would be different, but that's going to be a factor sometimes, I would assume.
Mr. Chair, we have a process in place, like I mentioned, that interchange program that was part of the Chapter 152, where there was $20 million for Metro, $20 million for Greater Minnesota, and then last year you also passed, I believe, $40 million again. We have a process in place that goes through, and we have members from DEED on that committee that help us come up with a priority order based on what they do as far as economic development or safety or whatever the issue may be for that interchange. So it is not a program that it's gonna, whoever puts in the most money is gonna get top priority. It's not one it's a program that's going to help the community. It's going to bring new jobs. It's going to help our transportation system and the local system.
The question that I've been having from some of the members is the fact that they're concerned that you're taking money that supposedly went for a project that was programmed and delaying that one and moving this one ahead. And I'm sure that's going to be an issue every time you talk about it. And in this sense, it's my understanding, supposedly, and you explained that too, we did have a separate money there for interchanges that was specifically designed for that. But you're going to run into a situation where you don't have that money and you have someone coming in, and invariably you're going to get questioned about why are you taking that project and pushing right back.
It is, Mr. Chair, it is an interesting discussion, and I don't know if you want to get into that. When I was in the Metro District, we had discussions with our planning folks. Sometimes we had private people come up and say, okay, there's this interchange that's programmed for 10, 15 years down the road. But the private people, the owner, wants to say, well, I'll pay you some of it, cash money for us to build it faster. Can you do that? Well, then the question comes up, in my mind, you say, well, there's one advantage. You advance something, build it much sooner, it'll be much cheaper. It brings in an additional, if the pie gets bigger, you bring in new, whatever, let's say in case of United Health, with $5 million into the system. The public dollars was not spent. That's one way of looking at it. And another way is that, well, are you pushing specific projects back because that was programmed to be done? And for this case, for this project, it wasn't. We didn't do that. We didn't push anything back. But So that's that is an interesting discussion to have.
I think it's probably going to be more significant when, in fact, this time we had some stimulus monies, whether they played into the decisions or not. It wasn't used stimulus monies, but there were some monies available, and I think every succeeding year that we have now, you're going to be faced with that issue about saying you're moving another project back, when, especially when there was no monies over and above what we have in a normal formula or budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a concern that I would have, too, or the committee would have, is how you would be addressing those in the future.
Mr. Chair, that is a good point. And when the last stimulus program, I mean, they talked about you should fund projects that don't have any money, are not in the program anywhere. So stimulus money came about. You got to do it right now. You got to create jobs right now. Here's the money. So that project gets done much earlier than something that was programmed way back. So, yeah, that's part of it. And no secret, there sounds like the second round of it coming too. So, we're here.
Is there anything that the department needs in that particular? You need any legislation as far as who's going to make that determining? We don't want to get the political arm in that deep as far as who makes determine on those projects. I mean, I would see that it could be a sensitive issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, is there any legislation needed?
Mr. Chair, I think once it becomes a little clearer if it truly is going to happen. I remember last year it was November when we started to talk to our districts and start putting the projects together. If something like this happens, if the time was before the elections, and if the administration Obama came on, it was going to happen, and it did. So that was all indications. So we were getting ready for it. We haven't quite done that yet, although we have a long list of projects that can start. Of course, we want to see what kind of message and guidance comes from the national, from the USDOT, what expectations there are. My guess is some of it is the same. I've seen some. I saw, I haven't read it yet, but I saw a letter came from U.S. Secretary to all the governors talking about that. One was to break up the projects into smaller projects for the purpose of to help minority businesses to get more work. And this is to all governors around the state. So I don't know what the guidance will be, but I think we have a process in place. We learned from last time, and I think I don't think it'll be a political pick. I think we'll have the right projects in place.
One last question before you leave. Does it appear that there's additional stimulus money coming again? I hear and see that. Or what's the department assume? That you're going to have additional stimulus money again or not? Just one time? Basically, I understand there was some money that wasn't at the federal level was available.
Yes. What we're hearing is what everybody else is hearing, that there's a jobs bill that's going to be possibly attached to a Department of Defense bill that will... Sounds like the same level of funding that we got last time for infrastructure. I think it was $50 billion nationally last time for transportation, and over half of that last time was for roads and bridges. The rest was for transit. So the story changes every day. So what numbers they're talking about? So we're kind of getting our vibes from this. The communications and watching TV programs, and some of you folks probably know better.
Okay, unless there are any further questions?
I'll stick around here if it's okay.
Okay. No, I didn't know if we were going to stick around or not. That's
no, I canceled all my other holiday parties, so I'm here.
Okay. That's great. Okay.
So Brad Larson can continue.
Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brad Larson with MnDOT's Office of Financial Management. I'm the department's new Director of Traditional and Innovative Finance, and I'm leading the department's new Innovative Finance Initiative. And I'm going to talk first about our overall Innovative Finance Initiative, of which public-private partnerships is one area that we're exploring within that. And then I'll talk about how we're looking at public-private partnerships, types, and some of the project examples we're looking at. First of all, we define innovative finance pretty broadly. It's essentially the practice of exploring, developing, testing, and implementing new revenue streams, new financing techniques, and new types of partnerships, all with the goal of accelerating transportation improvement. We've been doing innovative finance for the past several years at MnDOT, but we are really now taking a much more focused approach in developing a new innovative finance program. This is the vision that we've created for the program. It's really about trying to expand our funding sources and our financing techniques and do it in an accountable, transparent, fiscally responsible manner. You can see the mission that follows from the vision that we have about working with others to try to develop and implement these new innovative finance approaches. You can see the objectives we have for the program about exploring and assessing in a collaborative manner new and non-traditional approaches, establishing a framework for identifying innovative finance projects and programs, evaluating the results of the approaches that we test, and then trying to integrate innovative finance in the standard way we do business.
Just an honest, excuse me. Members, you do have that in your packet in case you can't read it too well.
Where we're currently at in the development of this program is on this slide, education, outreach, and communication. One of the keys to developing a successful innovative finance program. These efforts are both internal and external. We've held some workshops. We've been meeting with various individuals and groups talking about innovative finance. We've been developing some communication materials, and we've got a new website that was on the front page of this PowerPoint. We've also been taking a look at the current laws in this area and legislative needs in this area. A couple of the areas that we've been looking at specifically are in the area of TIFIA. TIFIA is actually the Federal Infrastructure Bank Program, which provides low-interest loans, credit enhancement, and lines of credit to states, state DOTs, for transportation projects. We're currently one of the few states that doesn't have express authority to apply for and receive assistance through the TIFIA program. Also been looking at some alternative financing authority. We also do not have clear express authority currently to enter into financing agreements with some governmental and primarily non-governmental, like private entities, non-profit entities. We don't have authority like that. We've also looked at the current toll facilities public-private partnership statute that we do have on the books. It actually was one of the first public-private partnership laws passed in this country back in the mid-90s. Yet we've only attempted to use it one time, unsuccessfully, in the 212 toll road project back in the mid to late 90s. We've been looking at a couple of the more problematic provisions from an innovative finance standpoint that exist in that statute right now, but I think where we're leaning and looking at that is we think that some of those changes to that law would probably be best approached when we can identify a specific project that we want to bring to the legislature for consideration and then pursue those types of changes around a specific project rather than doing it in general. We've been doing project assessment and screening. This has been both an external and internal effort where we've been looking at innovative finance projects around the country and around the world that appear to have been successful or have the potential for success and have some of the elements that might make them replicable, able to replicate here in Minnesota. We've also been taking a look at the projects we have in our program and our plan to see what types of innovative finance approaches might be able to help some of those projects. As I said, we're looking at integrating innovative finance thinking concepts, approaches into the ways we do business, which is one of the long-term keys to a successful innovative finance program. We've been doing research, this both market-based type research that we've done in the past, and we're looking at some academic research currently. Center for Transportation Studies is doing some research for us on protecting the public interest in public-private partnerships. And last but not least, the area that most folks are interested in is the types of innovative finance concepts and approaches that we've been exploring, of which public-private partnerships is one of those areas. And there's many of those areas, but public-private partnerships is just one of them.
So I think, excuse me, Representative Horstman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, you mentioned something as you were just talking on the first point under TIFIA before you got to the toll facilities point about not having the current legal authority to do something, and then you went on to talk about the tolling statute. Were you referring to public-private partnerships, or what do you not have the specific legal authority to do that you just mentioned?
Yeah, we've kind of characterized it under this area of alternative financing authority. This comes down to we don't currently have the authority to enter into financing agreements with certain entities to finance transportation projects and accelerate them. Say with private entities, we don't have that. Outside of the current toll facilities P3 statute, which would enable us to do that on toll facilities. If it wasn't a toll facility, we don't have any authority to do a financing agreement with a private entity. Also, nonprofits and certain other governmental entities, it wouldn't be clear whether or not we could like enter into a financing agreement with like a port authority or a rail authority or possibly a pension quasi, you know, non-profit pension type fund, those types of things.
I'll just have a follow-up when he's done with his next slide then.
Okay.
This is my last slide, and this is just talking about public-private partnerships now. Public-private partnerships are defined differently depending on who you talk to and where you go in the world and the country. Really, any time that a public entity contracts with or works with a private entity, it could be called a public-private partnership. In fact, most areas around the country, they consider just design-build type projects, which you're going to hear more about today, as public-private partnerships. We really haven't defined public-private partnerships that way here. The way we've been looking at public-private partnerships is really when you have a money element involved in the public-private agreement. And how we've defined public-private partnerships, the first kind is private contribution, P3s. This is where a private entity is actually contributing money or right-of-way into a project and is not going to be repaid for that contribution. The example that we already talked about a little bit was the 169 Bren Road project, where United Health Group was contributing $5 million into that, about a $20 million project. We're currently working with DEED and the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority to explore methods to promote economic growth and development through doing more private contribution P3s. Because when you take a look at the potential economic benefits associated with the 169 Wren Road project, they're significant. Not only from the immediate benefits that you get by the infrastructure construction, but also by the longer term benefits of the expansion of United Health Group and the number of jobs that are going to be created by that expansion. The next area of public-private partnerships that are out there are private financing P3s. And these are the types of agreements where the private sector is contributing money to a transportation project with the expectation of being repaid for that investment. So whether or not it's private debt or private equity that's being brought to the table, they will be repaid at a specific interest rate or return rate on that investment. Examples of these are some of the more noteworthy, the types of examples that get a lot of the press throughout the country are the Virginia I-495 Capital Beltway Hot Lanes Project, Florida I-595 Hot Lanes Availability Payment Project, the Canada Line Passenger Rail Project in Vancouver. There are many. These are big design, build, finance, operate, maintain types of public-private partnerships. There are many other types of private financing P3s out there, many other examples. There's just design, build, finance examples for both big projects and very small projects. Michigan has accelerated a couple smaller pavement preservation type projects using design, build, finance P3s. There are other types of P3 projects in the transit area, in the freight area. There's different shadow tolling type P3s projects that have been done as well. But they're all private financing. The private company is going to be paid back for that investment. And then kind of the third category of P3s comes down to more of these collaborative resource type sharing public-private partnerships, which we've had pretty successful experience with here in Minnesota with a couple of them, the Minnesota GuideStar Board, which handles our ITS and has been instrumental in developing a regional traffic management center. And then the TARA Board, which has been a more recent form of this type of P3, and they've been overseeing some of the efforts that get done at our Minroad Research Facility. So that's, in a nutshell, how we're looking at P3s at MnDOT.
Yes, Jen Horton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, then, so on the previous slide you had, we were talking about what the department doesn't have legal authority to do, and I'm assuming by the first bullet point here that the commissioner and the governor are under the impression they have the legal authority to do this type of a project. And I'm just wondering what the difference is between this and what you were saying you didn't have the legal authority to do, and where the legal authority comes from to enter into this kind of a, almost a fee-for-service project.
Yes, on the previous slide, the alternative financing authority, that's financing, so it's not a contribution type project. That's where you're entering into an agreement with a private entity and they're going to be paid back for that investment. Currently, the only authority we have to do private financing P3s is within the current toll facilities P3 statute. And so that statute only covers toll projects. And so if you wanted to try a P3 financing approach on a non-toll project, we do not have clear authority anywhere in law to do that.
Representative Horton.
So I guess with regard to the Wren Road project, is it the department's position and they have the legal authority to receive contributions?
Correct.
And so that is the category that this falls under?
This is Chair, Representative, correct.
It just strikes me that this is a different area of the law that we're going into from a normal course of events where maybe MnDOT will determine they're going forward with a project and there'll be a contribution from people along the way to a sort of a different thing where the contribution comes and then that changes the order that the projects are done in. And so I'm just concerned about whether or not the department and the governor have the authority to do that under existing law, or if we need to do something.
Mr. Larson, you seen that needs legislation, or could you expound on that or question?
Mr. Chair and Representative, currently my understanding is that we do have the authority under existing law to accept contributions from private entities for projects. Overall, what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop a systematic approach to trying to a more programmatic type approach to try to do more of these in the future. And we're trying to tie, we're working with Deed and the PFA to develop ideas on how we can develop that type of approach where we can identify projects that would provide the types of job creation and job preservation, improve economic competitiveness, grow the tax base, and leverage more private investment into transportation improvements. We're not quite there yet to roll out this approach we've been discussing, but as far as your specific question about whether or not we have authority, it's our understanding that we do have authority to accept contributions of dollars towards projects from private entities.
The question I would have, then, when you're talking about the assumption is that you're getting it from revenue source or else future advance payments, like the Bloomington, when you got it from the city, that wasn't private, really, but that was based on advanced money. You just advanced Bloomington advanced money you paid them out of your normal budget. And the other situation is where you have a toll facility where you're revenue generator. But in other words, it would appear to me that you don't you're questioning whether you have authority just to do something and repay it out of your normal budget. Is that the difference between the two or not?
Correct. When it comes to private financing, where we actually have to repay a private entity for the money that they've put into a project, the only authority that currently exists is within the current toll facilities P3 statute, and that's only for toll facilities. So if we wanted to enter into an agreement with a private entity to finance a non-tolled facility, we do not have clear authority to do that.
Would, Mr. Larson, would that be federal legislation with the federal highway then based on the toll, or would that be the state legislation that we passed about 10 years or 15 years ago in the toll legislation, or what would that be, do you know?
I'm specifically talking about state authority right now. Federal authority.
I mean federal authority. When I speak of that, I mean federal authority only on federal roads. So you couldn't do it on a non-federal system. That's what I was wondering about. Some of these, so far, all your public-private partnerships, I think, have been on the federal system, not on the state system, where you have strictly a state system road. That could happen. Like a state trunk highway that's not on the federal system, right? That's not happened yet.
Yes. Depending on the type of agreement you're looking at getting into, you may need some federal authority. It may not be legislative federal authority. It may be just approval from FHWA that you may need to do some of these types of agreements.
And when you get into the other types on the bottom, where you say other types of P3s, where it's probably like the Min Road and some of those, they're actually giving contributions to run the facilities. I just assumed that was always MnDOT monies, not monies, but I know the university and some of the other some other groups put money in it. But when you explained it, it sounds to me that's a separate entity other than MnDOT, like the MnRoad and the GuideStar. Is that correct?
These boards, MnDOT chairs both of these boards, and each of these boards consists of members from private entities as well as public entities. And these entities are primarily their idea sharing and resource sharing type entities. They do, as with the Terra board, they do try to solicit like pooled funding type demo projects that they can implement at the MnRoad Research Facility. So some of that goes on, but they're primarily the public sector and private sector trying to share ideas, share time and effort, to come up with new types of, they're mainly research and development type ideas, but some deployment.
Yeah, you don't repay those.
No, they're just collaborative type approaches, yeah.
Mr. Sahijo.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to follow up on Representative Horton's question about whether we have authority, and I think maybe the way we have done it over the past few years, other examples are like the Best Buy facility in Richfield, and where is it $21 million on 494, $21 million project, $7 million was Best Buy, $7 was Richfield, $7 was MnDOT. What happens with those agreements is we don't get the money directly from MnDOT, the state doesn't get it directly from the private company from Best Buy, we do an agreement with the city. So it works through the city, and we have other loans directly with other government agencies, the counties. For example, we've had Anoka County or Dakota County help us advance, and also down in Scott County, advance the interchanges, and then they would pay for it now, and we will pay them back when we have the dollars programmed. So what's legal about it is that it goes through a city. Is how we do it now.
Representative Horton?
I'm sorry. I just have one more question for one more right now. For Mr. Larson, you were saying, though, you don't have the parameters figured out for when you'll receive these private contributions and go ahead with a project, and yet we're going ahead with a couple of the projects. So I guess I'm concerned that the parameters aren't figured out yet, and we're going ahead. And the reason I raise it is the question of fairness comes up with the general taxpayer that doesn't have the ability to contribute and drive a project in a certain place. Is the general taxpayer being treated fairly? For example, out of that interchange fund, I'm sure it could fund an interchange out in greater Minnesota where, there's an ethanol plant that needs to get loads onto the local highway. And they might say to themselves, well, I kind of thought we were next. We were maybe going to have access to this interchange money, but we don't have $5 million. So even though we have a need, we're not going to get our interchange. And I guess, how would you address that kind of a fairness question for the taxpayer?
Mr. Larson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a good question. The 169 Bren Road project and the Elk Run project, they're both coming out of the interchange solicitations that were passed by the legislature the past couple years. The dollars were split evenly between greater Minnesota and the metro area. And what MnDOT did with both of those interchange solicitations is we tried to test out some of the ideas in those solicitations for how could you create a program here that does that is equitable, that is fair to everyone, and does do some of the things that I was talking about, in that you're creating and preserving jobs, you're improving economic competitiveness, and you are trying to use public dollars, stretch public dollars as far as you can by leveraging private investment in some of these improvements where the private sector is the one benefiting from or having a big benefit from the improvement itself. And I think we've learned some things from these solicitations and some of the types of projects that we approved through those solicitations. And so going forward in the future, we're working with DEED and the Public Facilities Authority to try to draw some parameters around, if we were to continue to do this in the future, how would we do it? And that is exactly one of the things, is making sure that there is good equity in these types of projects, that there's equity between Metro, Greater Minnesota, between urban areas, rural areas, equity in the sense of jurisdictional equity, that it's not just about trunk highway improvements or just about highway improvements. It's about improvements on both local and state highways, plus it's improvements on all modes. It's not just about highways. It's about port developments and transit and developments and rail improvements, and also looking at doing it in a way that we are not taking dollars away from some other project that is currently in the program and delaying that project. One of the overall guiding principles in our whole innovative finance initiative is to try to grow the pie with the types of concepts we're exploring here. It's about supplementing traditional sources and traditional financing techniques, not replacing them. It's about trying to do more projects overall and not displacing and delaying some projects for other projects. And that's one of the overall guiding principles we have. So that's what we're trying to work towards here, and that's kind of what I was talking about when I talked about not having the parameters complete yet. So.
Representative Hofer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Larson, kind of along the same line, given the two projects that you've referenced, how was the contribution either in right-of-way or the $5 million, how was that apportioned to local versus state contribution? In other words, if these projects had a local match requirement, did the $5 million go all towards reducing the local match, or what's the policy around that in these projects?
Mr. Larson?
That so far has been handled on a project-by-project basis. How it works. These projects are all very complicated. They're tied up in our cost participation policy, and how our cost participation policy works with each project determines how much of a cost responsibility a local government has in a project as opposed to the state. And like with the Elk Run project, there the right-of-way donation was actually was you covered the local cost share on that project, and on the on a project like the 169 Bren Road, there it didn't really become that big of issue. I think if you look at the private contribution and the contribution from the city, the city's contributing about $5 million to the project, and United Health Group contributed $5 million. That's probably over and above what their cost share was on the project.
Mr. Chair, whose cost share? When you say they, I'm not sure who you're speaking.
The local government, the local government cost share on that project.
And so,
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, if I might, in the case of the, isn't Elk Run by just north of Rochester?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah, by Pine.
So in that case, the local taxpayers, either Olmsted County or Rochester, they got all the benefit of this deal, if you will, as far as from a fiscal standpoint. And in the case of the Bren Road 169, did the $10 million exceed what it should have been, the local share of that project?
I'll get you a specific answer on that. I believe that it did, but I can't tell you exactly by how much it exceeded the local cost share under our cost participation policy.
And Mr. Chair, I mean, I think it is important that we look at this, that representing a community that has four interchanges, three of which have either been built new or redone at huge both county and city cost, and a fourth one needing to be done in the near future, and not having any big daddy industries, at least that I'm aware of, that have money to throw around to help build interchanges. It doesn't seem quite right that on an interstate system, of which both of these projects also are on, that we would have that disparity of cost to local taxpayers for fair share of what is definitely regional, if not state, infrastructure improvement. So I do have some concerns with this.
That's the question that I'm concerned about, too, because it's going to, I think it's going to be worse as time goes by. Right now, we only seen the initial projects happening, and it's going to really open up. I've had some legislators asking me the same question, and that's why I'm concerned. That's why I think perhaps there'll be some legislation developed that can maybe help address the problem somehow.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that there's probably some tax benefit to this donation as well, so I'm assuming that...
There's quite a bit of tax benefit.
I'm assuming that the taxpayers as a whole also saw reduced revenue as a result of this donation that benefited, in general, a local community.
Yes, that's a big ticket, and some of them might be getting a tax benefit.
Mr. Chair... I think that the way I see, maybe I'm seeing it too simple, but the idea is to bring and to have, maybe this Bend Road was one that started the conversation. Again, we've done this before where private money somehow got into a system where the private industry wanted it. But the idea is to try and bring those dollars in where there's willing partners and they want to do that and advance it. And the other benefit that we see is, like, for example, United Health one on 169 and Bend Road, is they tell us 1,600 new high-paying jobs, and I don't know what that means to how many dollars that is to the general fund as far as tax dollars. So I think that's the benefit. We see that as a benefit to the state. Otherwise, they wouldn't be improving there, and I don't know what they'd do then. So that's the idea, to do that. And I agree there are places where we pay for the whole thing, or us and the city and county pays for all of it, and the local businesses don't. But we want to start looking at it a different way to bring in those dollars. Maybe other businesses will look at this and say, well, United Health got their project, maybe they'll do the same. Their project advanced. And the other thing I just wanted to say about the Elk Run project, that's not just the benefit to the little town of Pine Island. I mean, that's going to bring high-paying jobs to the state, new businesses. Plus, what we're doing is, on Highway 52, we're closing 18 access points, and it's a big safety project for us that was planned to be done as part of the Orinoco project, which completed, but we didn't have the dollars. So this kind of expedited that whole thing, so it's a big, so it's in line with what we wanted to do. Anyhow, so this development advanced that whole program down in Elk Run.
Any further questions? No, thank you. And I guess you see the problem we're having, and they'll probably be looking at with you some legislation perhaps to address some of these problems that we're questioning. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
We do have a quorum, too, and if I presume some of the members that looked at the last, that were here at the last committee meeting, if you would, someone would move the minutes of the last committee meeting. Was that Representative Newton? Is that who it was? Representative Newton moved the minutes of May 23rd. Any questions or additions? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? The minutes are approved. The next person is Mr. Donis, right?
He wants me to stay with him. Is that okay?
He probably needs a little support. Mr. Donis, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I plan to be brief today and just provide an update on some testimony I provided about 2 months ago about where the locals are with their bridge replacement program and their program for the upcoming couple of years. When we testified in August, we had just preliminary numbers. We were still in the midst of construction season, and what we put together for the committee was based on our best available information. Now, during the last few months, we've had time to communicate with agencies and begin talking about what they have in mind for last year. It's remarkable to see how many bridges they actually replaced this past year, and with the ARRA program in particular, they replaced quite a few bridges in other words, got them off our bridge master list, and a lot of those were fracture critical bridges and very expensive bridges that justified them going through the federal paperwork and taking care of those. So 2009 was a very successful year for the construction of bridges as far as the locals were concerned. Without dwelling on that much longer, for 2010, though, their program is proposing, and this is based on resolutions of city councils and county boards and township boards across the state, a total of 923 bridges with an estimated total replacement cost of $301 million. Now, this would be from all funding sources. And then looking ahead to 2011 and getting us into 2012 for the federal funded programs to keep those continuous, we usually provide the match money on federal programs. We're looking at an additional 306 bridges with a total of $120 million of cost. Now, that's all sources of funding. Funding is used to lever and to provide, to make all the other programs that bridges, including local dollars, make them all work, and to also give us the opportunity to influence. These numbers on bridge costs are quite large. They're far in excess of anything that any recent bridge bonding amount has been, and I think, Chairman Leader, that's one of the points that you wanted me to try to make today, is that there is a lot of bridge needs out there. They're far in excess of what bridge bonding could ever hope to replace, and it is necessary for local agencies working through with MnDOT and the Division of State Aid to prioritize where those bridge bonding dollars go. And we do try to take those priorities. We look at projects that are on higher traffic roads, and we look at fracture critical now is a new thing that we're looking at and trying to go after those, because not only are those of public concern because of safety issues that may exist with those once they start to deteriorate, but there's also a very high maintenance cost on owning a fracture critical bridge to make sure that the bridge is still serving and that any of the critical members is still it requires annual inspections and annual detailed inspections by highly qualified inspectors, and it makes sense to try to replace those whenever the opportunity comes about, as well as the lower priority bridges. Another thing we are looking at is eliminating bridges whenever we can, and the program is called Road in Lieu of a Bridge. It's not an easy sell with the public in most cases who don't want to change their routes of travel, but in the big picture, the fewer bridges the state owns, the larger our investment in structures, the lower our yearly depreciation costs and our reinvestments is going to be, the lower our risks is going to be. So anytime we can replace a bridge and get the traffic to use a bridge that's a mile downstream or a mile upstream, I think everybody's better off, and so we work with those programs. So we have those very high needs. We're very aware of the need to prioritize. We're working with the counties, the cities, and the townships to do the prioritization. We've got bridge plans that are laying in our office since 2007, since our thinking, which had been first come, first serve. We worked with the local agencies, and as they themselves felt a bridge needed to be replaced, we would go out and look at it with them. And if we agreed, we gave them permission to start advancing them. As soon as the plan got in our office, we gave a number, just like when you go to the return shelf at Target, and it was first come, first serve as the money came in. We no longer do that. They have to meet some of the criteria that, Chairman Leader, you've been advocating to us, high traffic count, functionally obsolete to a degree, structurally obsolete to a certain level. High to the bottom of the creek, so that the failure would be more catastrophic than over some of these more shallower structures, and expensive structures. So we are working with that. We like the flexibility of being able to do this within the bridge program as it is currently defined. Then the other piece of information I can tell you is that right now our waiting list, the plans that are in our office waiting for funding, there are 96 bridges, and the total cost on those bridges for bridge bonding, what they're asking for bridge bonding so that they can move forward, is $10 million.
How many million did you say?
$10 million for these 96 bridges that our plans are laying in our office right this minute. We have, I mentioned earlier, there's a 923 bridges that are moving down the pipeline that the counties have and cities and townships have some intention of replacing this year. They told us by resolution they want to replace them. That total replacement cost is $301 million. But as far as actually having arrived at our office, there are 96 bridges, and they are short funding and needing bonding $10 million. So that's the money we could shovel out the door tomorrow if we had it, $10 million, to get these 96 bridges up and running. In addition to that, the federal program for the coming three summers, actually, anticipating what's coming forward, because we have historically always provided the match money for those federal funds for the actual construction of the bridge, not the related costs, is nearly $8 million. We also have contact with local agencies that are working on some high visibility projects that are going to take some time to develop, and they're not just a simple bridge. They're a complicated bridge and road. Sometimes they have urban involvement, but they're the type of projects that, not unlike some of the things that Brad was talking about earlier, that have many elements to them, and they've all got to come together at once. And so they've kind of put an early feeler out that if they would get their plans completed for this project, would they be able to count on any bridge money if a bridge bonding bill passed? And we've told them that project does sound like a high priority project to us, meeting the criteria. And the total of those costs is about $5 million. So those are projects that are moving forward with an awful lot of public attention. And so the total of those three types of projects are right now $23 million. And here we sit, middle of December. On the handout that I gave you there, too, in the very middle, it talks about the total bond funds needed for the biennium, $145,317,000. That would be our best guess, probably on the high side, because it isn't totally prioritized yet, of the bonding money that the local agencies are asking for from this bonding session to carry them forward for 2 years. That would be what they think they could spend. And as I've talked, we need to prioritize that. There's no way that I would anticipate that kind of bridge bonding money being available. And then to give you a number on the low side, today we would be able to obligate $23 million for those bridges where the plans are already in our office, federal funding is already committed, or there's a high-profile project moving forward requiring multiple approvals, and we wanted to make sure that our bridge funding wasn't a barrier. The total of those is $23 million. So on the low end, $23 million of bridge bonding. On the high end, $146 million of bridge bonding is what this handout is showing.
Mr. Jonas, is that strictly the bonding monies that you need to match, or is this the total cost of everything with the local and everything, or is it you're talking strictly bonding monies to match that local, whatever local other monies you have? This is total cost, in other words. This would be, if you didn't have any other monies, this is what it would cost totally if you funded it all with bonds. Is that what you're saying, huh?
Mr. Chairman, the $145,317,000,000 in the middle of the page on that handout that you've got, that would be just strictly bond dollars for the program for the next 2010, 2011, and the 2012 federal projects. If we look above that, the chart shows the unmet bridge needs that the local governments have identified to us. Their total request is for 923 bridges with a total estimated cost of $300 million. And of that, if we go to the far right, they're asking for $103 million of bonding money.
So in other words, there's other money over and above the $145 million. That's the question I'm asked. The big problem is the difference between needs and wants, and that's what I was trying to... We met before, just for the members of the committee. I've met with Mr. Jonas a few times. You know, if you give everybody what they want, we never have enough money, and there's a difference between needs and wants, and that's what we're looking at here, and that's why they're going to look a little bit harder. It was interesting to note, we went back to the 2006, 2007, 2008, the average cost of a township bridge, and I see here it says $179,300, it was $181,000. No, that's township bridges. Now, you all know the traffic counts on the township bridge. One of the problems we're running into in the rural areas, the bridges generally may be sufficient or structurally adequate for cars and trucks, but the farm, we're running into townships, they want a wider bridge. That's why we're running into problems, and that's why the costs are so high. And I think, realistically, and Representative Hausman's going to speak, I'm sure now, going to call on her, but there's just not enough money in here. They're going to have to start to prioritize, because you can't have a bridge every mile. That, there's no doubt about it. Representative Hollister.
Mr. Chair, I think I've asked this in years past. These are the quantified requests, but how many bridges in a year can your office actually process? All of the work that would be required to move that set of bridges through your office to bonding completion.
Mr. Jonas.
Representative Housen, Mr. Chairman, the last 4 years our program has been fairly consistent with the exception of the ARRA program, and we've been replacing between 150 to 160 local bridges, and the cost has been $175 million total cost from all sources of money.
Federal, local, state.
Yes. And that's... So I'd say the last 4 years we've been within 10% of that number, so that is becoming what our ability to deliver looks like. But last year we did fund an additional $30 million to bridges through the ARRA program and manage that with very little difficulty. So I guess we do have some additional capacity, but that's been the size of our program. Representative, as the chairman indicated to you, I provided you a number of $146 million. There is a difference between needs and wants, and those are the wants of the county board by resolution. So they're not dreams. They're sincere wants. They would like to maintain their county in their current condition and maintain its economic vitality in the way that it has existed over the years. But it's becoming more and more apparent that that amount of money is just not going to be available from the bonding program, that $146 million, and we have to prioritize. Buried within that, if you look closer on the gray shaded line, the town bridge projects for 2010, and they show up at $56 million for 2010. The township bridge program is about $15 million a year, a little less. And that's what we use to fund those. And once in a while, we'll give them a little match money from one source or the other, depending on the nature of the project. If they run into some particular historic issues or something like that. But for the most part, that money which comes out of the 5% distribution funds those township bridges. And we see that activity of those projects moving forward. Again, $15 million of the projects against $56 million of the needs. When you look at some of those projects in comparison with a county road bridge, the smaller bridge, lower traffic volume, and off the beaten path, not to be confused with our normal federal projects and our normal bridge bonding programs, but those types of projects do exist out there. There is a need for them. There is a modest amount of money, and the township. We work closely with the township to prioritize them already. We give very little bridge bonding money to the townships for those types of projects.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify then, so I was just trying to get at the capacity of your office, and you said generally that's between 150 and 160 bridges. You said this year you did another additional $30 million. How many bridges was that $30 million?
About 30 bridges, $30 million this year.
30 bridges?
30 bridges, about $1 million a piece this year.
So if you just looked at the max you've ever done, it would be 190 bridges that your office has been able to process.
Representative, Mr. Chair, that would be the maximum of the last 5 years. I'm sure if we go back into the 80s and the 90s, we had bigger programs, bigger years. But in the last 4 or 5 years, we have had a pretty stable program, and that has been the level of it. And I don't think that the level is really established by the ability of our office to check the plans and oversee the programs and all of that and with the paperwork. It's to do with the ability to prepare the plans and for the industry to bid on and keep the prices at a reasonable level. I mean, all that comes into play. But our office this year, well, we did hire extra help because of our program, to seasonal help, to help us deliver the program. I'd like to think that our office did not limit the ability of the state to deliver bridge projects.
Any further questions? Did you have anything more, Mr. Jonas?
No, Mr. Chair.
See, I think we can let you go then. Okay. With the next gentleman, I will let you pronounce your name again, because I think I have it wrong. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Hippus, and I'm MnDOT's Director of Innovative Contracting. I'm going to give you an overview of MnDOT's Design Build Program, where we've been the last couple of years, where we're currently at, and a few upcoming projects that we currently have programmed and ready for letting. If you're not familiar with Design Build Contracting,
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we've spent a lot of time on Design Build in this committee and some different bills and lots of time on the issue. So could you tell us, or do we have peace in the valley with the contractors? Just looking through this, I see you've made some changes. Are we still having the Hatfields and the Coys, or can you kind of give us kind of the lay of the land before we start your presentation so we kind of know how that's going?
I think we have peace in the valley. I was going to get to that as I get to the toward the 35W slide on it. But as you know, the 35W job was a very successful design build project, but yet very controversial in our scoring and selection process. We've been meeting very frequently with our partners over at AGC, the Association of General Contractors, and also the consulting community, ACEC, to come to some sort of resolution, what we can do to improve the program. So we were meeting for a while. We were meeting every other week for about four and a half months, listing out all the issues and where we can make improvements to the process. Based upon that, do you want me to skip ahead a few slides to that, if that's okay?
Representative Holberg, you were talking about basically, I think you could just about identify if they can pinpoint. Can you?
Mr. Chair, I don't want to destroy his presentation here, but just from a perspective of where we're at, and I mean, some of us believe in design build as a process, but it got to be just really a big pain in the butt because everybody was fighting about it. So I was just curious, are we still fighting or not? It sounds like we're not. Maybe we can just move through the presentation real quickly. I think a lot of us have already spent a lot of time on this issue.
You want them to go through it first? Me?
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. You're the chair. That's your call.
We'll let them go through it and then we'll get Okay, thank you.
Just to a brief 10,000-foot overview on design build. It's different than our traditional projects. Design build is where the contractor works directly with the designer. MnDOT only does about a 30% plan on the job before it goes to a request proposal, compared to our traditional projects where the plan is at 100% design and then let out to the low bid. So design build contracting, we bring the contractors and the designers together to work as an integrated team rather than both working separately under independent contracts for MnDOT. We also are allowed to do best value with design-build contracting. So between 2001 and 2007, we did 6 best value contracts. And these range in size from a $1 million sign replacement job in our District 4 near Detroit Lakes, all the way up to what we call our mega projects, our Route 52 through Rochester, our new trunk highway 212 in the southwest metro area, Interstate 494 in the west metro area from Highway 5 to 394. We also did a small interchange job out near Holly, which is a safety improvement project to accelerate construction to save lives due to some accidents in that area. We also did a job on Orinoco, a $37 million interchange back in 2005. So between 2001 and 2007, we spent about $652 million on design build contracting. As we all know, on August 1st, the I-35W bridge collapsed. With design build contracting, we were greatly able to accelerate this project. We had an RFP ready by mid-August. We were able to let the contract in September of 2007, execute a contract on October 8, 2007, and have the 35W, this vital transportation link, reestablished by September 18, 2008, less than a year after letting. Job was very successful, but as I talked about earlier, our scoring and selection process was somewhat controversial.
Excuse me, just a minute, resting the beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hippas, when we authorized this, I believe there was a restriction on the amount of design-build contracts we could let. It was either percentage of the number or the percentage of the total dollar volume. Can you remind me where that's at?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was 10% of the total number of projects that were let. We're currently around 1% or less. Okay. That's how we traditionally been. Some of the program changes that we've made is we've looked at our scoring process. Before, when we scored a proposal, all the contractors started at 0, and they had to build up to a maximum of 100 points. In order to be deemed responsive, which means that we'd actually accept their bid and have a contract with them, they had to achieve a minimum amount of points. Well, there were some inherent problems with that system. A lot of times we had sometimes unnecessary spreads in the points with it. A lot of times, to determine our responsiveness is not made until the very end, where it's too late, you could end up in litigation or a protest. So we decided to flip it around. And really what we're doing now is we're making that responsive determination very early in the process. We're going to notify the contractors very early if we think that their proposal is going to be rejected. They will then have time then to go through the proper channels to make sure that MnDOT has followed the correct procedures with it. If you are deemed responsive, you automatically get 50 points as a baseline. So the scoring numbers, instead of controlling the whole 100 points, now only control 50 points. So that inherently is going to probably match the scores a little bit closer. But it also lets MnDOT focus on really what the value is on a project. We found it was difficult sometimes on a 100-point scale to come up with things that are a really good value to put on a 100-point scale. But on 50 points, we can really focus on things such as, you know, quality of structures, how they're able to minimize maintenance in the future, and some of those things that really bring true value to the state. We also worked on revising what our responsive determination is. Instead of being based on a number of points, it's now based on, do you have a major flaw in your proposal? So it's much more clear on what exactly is determined to be responsive on it. We also agreed to not put conditions on our stipends. On the 35W job, we had certain conditions on the stipends, which limited some of their legal rights. So working with the industry, we've said the stipends is basically to pay for the intellectual property and to encourage competition, not to limit their legal rights. So we've looked at that issue with the industry also. We also made several changes and add more formal processes to our additional administration oversight. On the past practices, once the scoring was done, those scores were locked. So we went to letting, and the scores were invaded in public. We opened up their prices, and we did the little formula by state statute, and out came the apparent best value. We've now added some checks and balances to that process. Once the scoring members have finished their scoring, we then take that scoring back to the chief engineer, and we brief him before we do any type of public letting. And we say, here's what the proposals were. Here's the difference in the scoring. So they're able to see what the difference in the scoring is. And we're really able to say each point is worth X number of dollars. So you can go and ask the questions, well, this proposal has this many points. This one has this many points. How much is the difference between the two? Well, theoretically, there could be a $2 million swing in the bids. But this team being a higher score could actually win the job even though his price is $2 million higher. So we're able to debrief our top staff early on and say, this is why this proposal is worth this much more than this proposal. And if our top staff does not really agree with that assessment, they're going to send it back to the committee and say, you have not justified to me that this is a potential best value. We want you to reconsider. So there's a check and balance that's now put inside of the program. We're not just basing it on one score. There's a check and balance that sends it back and says, You even testified to me that there could be a significant dollar swing to justify the cost.
Mr. Chair?
Rustin Holberg.
Thank you. But to that point, aren't you putting a lot of power in one person's hands to send it back? In other words, how do you, I mean, you, I understand the concept of, you know, having that second look at it, but a committee and a compilation of scores coming out with a result and then just having one person that can throw the whole thing back, how is that justified?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to clarify the process, when the chief engineer sees it, he doesn't know who the contractors are, so he can't play any, have any bias towards one contractor or the other. We show him a blind score. We say there's five contractors and here's their scores. And we keep him shielded from actually who the bidders are. He cannot physically go and change the scores. All we can do is ask him to go back and say, I want you to think about this. I want you to reconsider again. So the committee then has the option to reconsider or not reconsider and move forward. So he does not have the power, he or she does not have the power to physically change the scores. All he can say is, he or she can say is, I think we want you to double check this before we go forward. So it's somewhat of a check, but not all, the authority is not given to one person.
And Mr. Chair, is the chief engineer always an employee of MnDOT?
As far as I know, yes. So, I'm not sure if there ever was a case with a chief engineer, but it'd be MnDOT's chief engineer.
All right, thank you.
And who's your chief engineer right now?
Mr. Hedgen, who's sitting behind So this is something that we've worked out with the industry. They wanted more of an oversight from top staff before we move forward with the project. They were very concerned on 35W with the large point swing and the large value swing. They wanted to have more top staff oversight in the process.
Jeff St. Champion? Or Russian Hoover?
Champion,
okay.
I know we sort of look alike. Here's my question. It is my understanding the reason why there's the transparency of bids being opened in public and not have been looked at prior to that time is because it prevents the whole idea of bid shopping. So can you explain to me how this change in the process will not encourage bid shopping?
It should not, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it should not encourage bid shopping at all. Once we are scoring the proposals, price is not at all a consideration. So we actually get the prices and the score separately. And as we're scoring them, the price is usually either still in the contractor's hand, they're refining their bid, and they're shielded from all the scoring is kind of working, or sometimes we get both at the same time, and the prices are locked in a file drawer. So the price really has no influence on what the scoring is. When we come to the actual letting, usually by the time we go to the chief engineer with the scores, we have both the price locked up and the scores in our hands. So the contractors are not able to bid shop at that point in time.
Does that answer your question? But what happens, in other words, you're having the bids letting, or you're going to have the contract letting, but in the meantime, you're looking at this ahead of the contract letting date, aren't you, or do I misunderstand you?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, the scoring is, at the letting, we publicly unveil the scores before we open up the prices. So there's transparency that we're not trying to match a score to a price. And that's all actually dictated in our state statute, where we go and publicly announce the scores, and then we publicly open up the prices in front of the contractors and the public.
I still got a little problem. When are you doing your responsiveness with the contractor prior to the opening and the letting, aren't you, or not?
Correct, prior to the opening and letting. So if we determined that somebody was non-responsive, before we came to the letting, we would send them a letter saying, you are deemed non-responsive, and we're not going to open up your bid. They would then have the opportunity to go through a protest procedure if they felt MnDOT was an error. Prior to the letting.
Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, Mr. Hippus?
Hippus,
okay. Is the review of the evaluation criteria and the review of the scoring, does that happen at the same time, or is it the criteria evaluated by the chief engineer prior to the bid process?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's two separate events. One is the review of the evaluation criteria, and that is before we send out the request for proposals. And the review of the actual scoring is at the end of the process. So he's checking to make sure we are the chief engineer, he or she is checking to make sure that we have not included items that may be too vague or subjective to score. It's a higher level review of the scoring criteria before we actually give it to the contractors themselves.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Josh, you may proceed.
We've added one additional step in terms of transparency on the 35W project that we award and executed the contract on the same day. We're going to be awarding the contract, and the award is basically, after we've gone through the letting, we determine who the apparent best value is. We then go through an award step, where we send the contractor a letter saying, congratulations, you've been awarded this contract, here's the contract, please sign the contract and send back your bonds to us. Now, at that point, it's not an executed contract. It's just a letter to them saying, here's some paperwork you need to fill out for us to execute the contract. At that point in time, all information is made public. And it's worked very well in the past couple projects where we make all of our scoring evaluations public, all the proposals are public, we send the contractors, all the contractors a link to the internet and say, we've awarded the job, here's the information, we have nothing, it's a complete transparent process that goes along with it. We then have agreed to wait 7 days before we execute the contract, just in case there's an issue where a contractor needs to protest the determination or not. There's some issues on 35W where once the contract is executed, there's less legal remedy for the contractors. They wanted to have an opportunity to review that scoring before MnDOT jumped into a contract. So we've agreed to a 7-day waiting period. Unless we have an emergency where we want to expedite that contract further, then we've worked with the industry to say, well, if you're okay with the results, can you waive your 7-day rights on it? So they've agreed to say, yeah, if it's an emergency, we have no issues with it. We want to go faster than 7 days. We'll agree MnDOT and send you a letter back saying we're okay with the 7-day period.
In other words, once you open at the letting, you open the bids, or you open their, open their bids, and the contractors can see it. The contractor that normally you would send a letter to and say you're going to award, he has 7 days, he or she does, and they could decide, well, doggone, we're too low, and we're not going to accept it. So regardless, does he or she have to accept it then, or can they reject it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a different step. If there's a little bid, they really can't back out unless there's a big, maybe material error in their bid.
The best buy bid is what we're talking about, right?
The best value. Yep, best value bid. So at the day of the letting, they know who the winner is. And the award is just basically telling them, here, you've been awarded the contract. Now, if they wanted to back out for some reason, that's a separate process. They'd have to come back to us and say, we had a material error in our bid, then that would you reconsider accepting us as the low bidder. Yeah, but the 7 days is the waiting period for the unsuccessful contractors to review the scoring information as part of the transparency process.
No further questions, sir.
Mr. Chair,
I
hate to ask this, so are you aware of any need for any design build legislation to pass in 2010 in order for this to work?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are considering some legislation to clarify some stipend language, but not to correct anything that has been done with our ACEC working group. But we may be coming with some legislation for some stipend clarification.
And Mr. Chair, are you aware of any opposition to this proposed stipend language that you're considering?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we met with our group, ABC, ACEC, a few weeks ago, and they were in support of the change of the stipend.
All good news, Mr. Chair.
Another question? What did you say?
I said all good news, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'd like to ask a question on that stipend. Is there a penalty other than an award in the stipend or not?
Mr. Chair, there's no penalty at all. The stipend is to pay the contractors to submit bids and to buy their intellectual property. If they don't submit a bid, they don't get paid anything at all. And if they are non-responsive...
Well, this is strictly a stipend for all contracts. I have to have liquidated damages, I assume you know.
Yeah, this is just for design-build stipends. When the stimulus package passed, the RF projects, there was $502 million for highways and bridges that was allocated. And along with the legislation, there were some legislation requirements on when projects needed to be authorized. And 50% of the funds needed to be authorized within 120 days of enactment. With our traditional projects, that meant that MnDOT had to develop a complete plan set, plan specification estimates, before we were able to get that federal authorization. But by using design build contracting, we only needed to go to a 30% job, a 30% plan set, and issue the request for proposals to get authorization. So in order to meet that deadline for ARRA, design-build really helped us because we could authorize projects faster because we didn't have to wait for a full entire plan set to be developed. I'm going to go through the ARRA projects that we recently completed or are working on. With the ARRA, we are using design-build on five projects. I'll give you a brief overview of these five projects. They range in size from $2.2 million to $47.8 million. In the past, we typically used design-build for major projects. And here we've kind of scaled down design-build. We're using it for more of the smaller to medium-sized contracts to get some more opportunities out there for some of our contractors. These jobs, so there's a $2.2 million box culvert, a $12.8 million bridge project on Interstate 90, a $16.5 million reconstruction project, a $47.8 million major grading project, and we have another project that we're letting in 2010, which is a bridge and grading project down in Savage. With design build and looking at how MnDOT approached the ARRA projects, we wanted to spread out jobs to different classifications. We didn't want all the jobs to go to paving contractors or signing contractors. We wanted grading contractors to get work. We wanted bridge contractors to get work. And design build really helped us expand those capabilities and opportunities for different contractors. To design a $40 or $50 million grading project in 120 days is nearly impossible. But with design build contracting, we're able to authorize those bigger jobs and get different varieties of work people to back to work. This job is the Highway 2. This is actually a low bid project. We did not do best value on this job. This is just west of Bemidji in the town of Wilton. Basically, we replaced bridges with a box culvert. We issued the RFP on May 7th, let the project on June 19th, and the job was designed and built and open to traffic by September 30th, with very low cost growth, less than 1%. Bridges of Marlette County are four bridges on Interstate 90 near the city of Austin. Two bridges that will get done have been completed this year, and two bridges next year. MnDOT issued the RFP on May 8th. The job was let on June 17th. With the completion date of September 1st of 2010, also with very low cost growth on this project. St. Peter was a major reconstruction project on 169 through historic St. Peter. This job was a very aggressive schedule for design-build contracting. We were going to detour traffic through the heart of downtown, so there were many business impacts. On this job, we had five different bidders, and we really allowed contractor innovation. We said, we want you to figure out how to stage this job to get traffic back on 169 in front of these businesses as fast as possible. And really saw some contractor innovation. We have five bidders and five different proposals. So the winning bidder was Schaefer Contracting, and they opened it up to traffic on November 16th. So design build contracting really helped accelerate this job to get it done on time. Our biggest job is the Highway 610 corridor. This is in the Northwest Metro through Maple Grove and the Maple Grove area, which is a new construction of Highway 610. It has six bridges, retaining walls, noise walls, storm sewer, utilities, a variety of work types for our contractors. This RFP was issued on May 15th. We let the project on August 14th. It will be done by July 2010. Your slides may have a different date for open to traffic. I apologize. There was a typo in there. But it will be open to traffic by July 1st of 2010. This project came in 35% below our estimate. I'm going to go through some of the reasons why the job came in as a surprise to us and how low the bids came in. So a lot of it was through contractor innovations. We talked to our engineers early on the project on, well, how high are we going to allow the contractor to raise and lower the roadway on this job? And our engineers were like, well, it's pretty tight what we have proposed right now. There's really not a lot of room for innovation. We allowed in our contract the contractor to go 3 feet up or 3 feet down. And here they're able to optimize their earthwork on the job. If they have different materials they can bring in or out of the job, it really allows for them to minimize the amount of work and save costs in the job. One of our contractors proposed a change to adjust the profile 9 feet. By adjusting the profile 9 feet, they're able to eliminate retaining walls, a lot of drainage, save on a lot of earth moving for the job. And we estimate through the innovation of design build contracting and what we call these ATCs, these contractor proposals, we saved about $6 million with design build contracting on this job. Another cost savings in this job was market conditions. There were just not a lot of grading contracts out there for work on. By using design build contracting with 610, we're able to get some of our grading contractors to work. The market was very, very, very competitive for grading contracts. Contractors also had different innovations too. They were able to reduce bridge risk. They proposed roundabouts instead of signal systems, which are cheaper for us to build initially, cheaper for us to maintain. And there was a lot of innovative staging. Keeping those roadways open to traffic across that corridor was very key. And the contractors brought some really unique ideas. They were able to build a bridge that's kind of offline and realign the roadway and keep the existing roadway open, things that we had not thought about internally as a department. So contractor innovation really was the key to that project being bid so cheaply. Because the 610 project...
That's also, you know, they should be aware that's a devil's, what do you call it, the devil's
triangle.
Devil's triangle project. Representative, this 610 was, isn't that correct?
No, that's a separate project.
That's a separate, I thought.
It's a separate project, yeah. That one's on 169.
Okay.
Yep.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heifetz, two questions I was going to ask about the stipend for intellectual property. But before I do, I know one of the things we ran into in some of the heartburn on the 35W letting was some adjustments that the contractors could make. Some of them claimed that, well, they thought that would be outside of the parameters and they couldn't make them anyhow. And I'm looking at the list of things you did here, the innovations that we did allow. How did we make all the contractors who were involved in putting proposals together, how were they aware of how much latitude they had to maneuver to give us this kind of savings? Or at that stage of the game, did we just let anybody come in and just talk, give us their best ideas without fear of repercussions or penalty or anything? You follow my question?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the contract is pretty clear on what the rules are for the contract. For example, on 610, we said, here's what you have to build in terms of the profile, and you're allowed to raise it 3 feet up or down. Our contract also allows for provisions for the contractors to be innovative. They're called alternative technical concepts. And those ideas we don't share.
Alternative what concepts?
Alternative technical concepts.
Yeah, that's the ATCs.
ATCs, yep. So they're able, before they bid, they're able to come to us and say, I know your contract says 3 feet, but I can move it 9 feet and possibly save you $3 million. And we go back and we look at those concepts and we either approve them or we reject them or we approve those with conditions. And as a check, as a central office function in charge of the design build program, we're kind of a consistency factor on this. So we review for the ACCs to make sure that one contractor does not have favors compared to the other contractor on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then, that's what I'm looking for, is what kind of a safeguard do we have so that contractor A comes in with some really great ideas? Do we then share those with contractors B, C, and D, and so they get a chance at them too? Or where's the protection for intellectual property? I would consider an innovative idea like 9 feet instead of three to be to be intellectual property almost.
Go ahead,
and educate us a little more about how this works and how we keep peace in the valley.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not share, as they're bidding it, we do not share the ACCs from one team to the next. Okay. They don't want their ideas shared back and forth. Mm-hmm. We do see peace. Now, the project manager receives the ATC, and he's the ultimate kind of authority on whether the ATC is rejected or accepted. But the check is with our office, so we're actually reviewing the ATC too. And if we see where he's accepted one ATC from one contractor and a very similar one, he's not accepting, we're going to jump in there and say, well, hold on a second. We need consistency and a fair playing field across the board. After the job is let and awarded, we're able to take the ATCs from another contractor and bring those back into the winning contractor and say, I know you didn't think of this, but the other contractor thought of this. Would you consider that?
Mm.
If he does consider that, then we take a credit to our contract and we receive money back off of the contract.
Mr. Chairman, last question related to this for now then. The stipend payments that you spoke of a little bit ago, for that, do we actually pay then Contractor D if he thought about, say, roundabouts, and the guy we actually let the bid to didn't think of them? Is that how we protect ourselves then for the good ideas a non-winning contractor may have thought about?
I'm not quite sure if I completely follow the question, but the stipend is only paid to the unsuccessful team. The winning contractor does not get the stipend on it.
So somebody who was not successful in getting the bid that thought up some cool idea that the winning guy didn't think of, we actually pay the stipends into the guys that didn't prevail.
Correct.
And then we have the right then to suggest to the winning contractor, try this. That was what I was trying to get the committee to understand, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Jay. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Would that be only if you used his idea, though?
In other words, do we pay them all? Sorry, Mr. Chairman. We pay everybody regardless of whether they use their cool ideas or not?
Yes. Yep. If they are responsive, we pay their proposal on it. That's dictated by our statute. It's a responsive and responsible proposer. the stipend is paid. So it's for intellectual property. It's also used to offset some of the costs. It's expensive to prepare a design build proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of learned a little lesson on that Highway 2 job I talked about earlier. That was a low bid, no stipend proposal, and we only received two bids on that project. And part of it was the industry saying, you know, cash is tight right now, and for us to spend money to chase after a job is not really in our best interest. If you would have paid us a stipend to offset some of those costs, not all the costs, we probably would have bid the job. So we probably would have had more bidders on the Highway 2 job had we paid a nominal stipend on the job.
Well, just oh, by the way then, Mr. Chairman, if, well, like on the 6-10 contract then, if you came up with some really great ideas that you paid stipends for, would we be able to recommend them to somebody, say, down in the Savage project that's coming up? Or are they specific only to each individual bid that's left?
They're typically specific only to the bid that's submitted.
Okay.
But all that information is public. So when a proposal comes in, that information is public. We actually post the successful and not successful proposals on the website. Mm-hmm. And the contractors, they all look at each other's proposals.
Okay.
So they're all gleaning ideas of what was accepted and what was not accepted as they move on to the next bid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a very helpful discussion.
Thank you. Okay, could you... I think somebody's a kind of summary.
Yep.
If you summarize it, we have a couple more testifiers. Yep. Not that this isn't important, but I think it's pretty much not generic, but it's total.
I'll jump down to the cost results just to see how design build is some of the cost of the recent bids. Our bids have all come in very close for these recent jobs. These are all our projects. We had no controversy, no protests. We've had a couple of meetings with the industry to kind of, we call them check-in meetings to see how things are going on it. You know, there were some bumps in the road on some of the jobs that went a little bit, maybe too fast in the procurement. But we've seen that our estimates are coming in pretty close to our awarded contracts amount. Beside our 610 project where, as I said earlier, the estimate was a lot higher than what the actual bid was. And that's contractor innovation, that's market conditions. And we also had a lot of contingencies and risk on that job with our estimate. So we overestimated the project. We looked at our base estimate. We're actually pretty close to the contractors, but we added in a bunch of risk items, which made our estimate go a little bit higher. Some other jobs that are coming up are the Hastings Bridge project. Here we're going to allow contractor innovation. We're going to allow the contractor to bid either a arch bridge, as shown in the bottom left-hand corner, or a cable bridge. We ran cost estimates, and both bridges are somewhat comparable. We thought, why not let the contractors be innovative and tell us which is actually the cheapest project. Our goal is to issue the RFP probably around the first of the year and have a contract executed by June of 2010. And then the Hastings Bridge will be replaced and open to traffic by the fall of 2013. The Elkhorn Interchange project is also a design build project that's currently programmed.
On that, are they going to have alternate bids or submit two bids or one bid? How are you going to handle that?
They will submit one bid.
On either one of the two, they can't submit.
Yep, we're going to allow them to submit either one. All right, so they'll submit one bid. So they'll spend the first month or so deciding which one is the most cost effective and then begin refining their bid during the rest of the procurement. Other design build projects, is we talked earlier about the Elkhorn Interchange. That's also design build contracting that was accelerated through the Greater Minnesota Interchange Solicitation. And their design build contract is being used to kind of work hand in hand with the developer on timing. When the development is done and when the interchange is going to be open on Highway 52. That project is currently programmed for letting in April of 2007. Just to summarize some of the statistics on how much we're using design build contracting. For the ARRA projects, of the $502 million that was allocated for transportation for highways and bridges, there are 93 design bid build projects for MnDOT. There will be 5 design build projects. 19% of the total ARRA funds will be design-build contracts, 5% of the projects are design-build. When you look at our total program, combining ARRA with our traditional projects, of the total number of projects let, we're at about actually 1.1% this year, and most of that's due to ARRA. If you look back in 2008, we let 0 design-build projects, but with ARRA, we've let a few more projects than we normally do. And we're at about 10% of our overall program value using design-build this year.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to Elk Run. Did we let that bid in April of 2007?
Oh, I apologize. I don't know why it's 2007. April 2010.
2010.
I apologize for that.
Yeah. My head was spinning there for just a second, but thanks. I feel better now.
Getting back to that Hastings Bridge, what if a contractor wants to submit two? It would appear to me that it's going to be quite a decision on a chief engineer. He or she could be biased, one of the two alternates. And if the contractor wanted to bid two, why couldn't he bid two? Either both designs.
Yeah, just to simplify, we're saying just submit the best cost one. We don't really don't want you to build either or. We want them to be able to refine and put their best foot towards the best bridge. It would be a lot of time and a lot of effort to develop two full bids on it, and we're just looking to score one proposal. We don't want to be scoring different proposals. If they submitted two bridges, we'd have to score two proposals, and we end up scoring more of a matrix than a list. So it really complex the process.
Well, aren't you going to be complex because of the design? Contractor's going to probably want to bid the lower design one, even if it may not, in his opinion, be the best value. I would think. I don't know. But anyhow,
we've debated this a lot, and you know, there's some questions about, are you going to score visual quality? Are you going to pick a pretty bridge versus a cost-effective bridge? We're not going to score the visual aspects of the project. We look at cost. We view both of them in terms of maintainability as the same. So in the eyes of MnDOT, we've told the industry, they're the same. We don't have a preference towards one or the other. So you don't get any points if you submit a cable. They're equal in our eyes on it. Just submit one that's a very cost-effective, high-quality bridge to us.
No further questions. Thank you very much.
And
we're just about, we have some time left, not time left, but we have a couple of short reports we'd like to get. Mm-hmm. And Representative Beard is going to comment. We also want to get some from the automobile dealers. If I could, just Representative Beard, you'll be here for a minute, right?
I will, yes.
I think someone's here from the automobile dealers or automotive group. Alyssa Chandler. I wanted her, someone to come in and just say what's happening as far as the designs or automobiles or what we're going to see as far as types, because we're concerned about revenue. And if they're coming in with a lot of hybrids or electric vehicles in the next year or two, I think we better start looking ahead for revenue source. So we just wanted to get a short synopsis of what's happening with the industry as far as design goes.
Sure.
Welcome to the committee, and thank you for coming.
Thank you for asking me, Mr. Chair. My name is Alyssa Chalander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Mr. Chair, basically, Abby had called and asked me to prepare some answers for that question. So what I tried to do is, you know, there are a lot of manufacturers that have a lot of emerging technologies and a lot of concept cars and things like that. But what I did is I looked only at the next few years and only at manufacturers who are actually developing technologies for commercial use in America, which I thought might be helpful for you. So basically, I thought you should maybe look at a few factors. First of all, the new corporate average fuel economy standards that will be coming into effect from the years 2011 model years until 2016. At the federal level, the federal government is going to be requiring manufacturers' fleets to get far more fuel efficient. That's probably the biggest factor with respect to the question of revenues from the gas tax. Cars, just for your frame of reference, right now manufacturers' fleets of cars have to average 27.5 miles per gallon. But by model year 2016, cars will have to average 42 miles per gallon. That's quite an increase in fuel economy over a pretty short period of time, and that's going to cause most of the manufacturers offering motor vehicles for sale to really, increase their small car offerings. Right now, we've got, you know, small car offerings that have a combined fuel economy rating of greater than 29 miles per gallon. There's really only about a half a dozen of them, and think things like the Mini Cooper, Toyota Yaris, Honda. I mean, the really small cars are what we're looking at for fuel economy miles per gallon over 30. As far as the hybrids and plug-in electric hybrids, I really think that it's premature to start worrying about an effect on the gas tax revenues. In 2009, hybrids as a market share really didn't even crack 3%.
And most analysts look at hybrids maybe gaining 0.5% per year in market share over the foreseeable future. And that's hybrids like the Toyota Prius, which has, that's the biggest seller when we're talking about hybrid vehicles. I mean, the Prius as market share of hybrid is almost 50% of that market. So, you know, I mean, you just kind of think of how many hybrids are out there. Prius are, you know, one out of every two. As far as the like plug-in electric hybrids, those aren't on the market yet. The biggest news there is obviously the Chevy Volt, which is the biggest, you know, highly anticipated new model coming. That is supposed to be available in November of next year, and is estimated to be about $40,000 per vehicle, which is, you know, it's well above average. And again, with a plug-in electric hybrid, most analysts are looking at maybe that is going to be 0.5% of the entire market of motor vehicle sales. So it's not really, I wouldn't say that those emerging technologies are really going to make a dent. I think the bigger thing to look at would be the federal government's regulation on fuel economy.
Thank you.
That helps.
The other thing, how about cost benefits to sales tax? Do they anticipate the cost, the vehicle cost would go up a little bit each year, or what? That's the sales tax item, too.
That's true. You're talking about the increase in fuel economy affecting the cost of the vehicle. Yeah, they do expect it to go up, although I don't have those figures in front of me. I can get them for you.
An average cost of the whole fleet, do you assume 2 or 3% a year? Is there a cost like that they work with or not?
There might be. I just don't know it right off the top of my head. Sorry.
Is there any questions? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Ms. Schlender. The related to the chair's question, and the registration fees on individual units that are sold, do you anticipate the sales volume to continue to grow? Not only the value of what's being sold, which would be sales tax, but the registration fees, annual registration fees on the number of new units, too, have an impact on what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, new car registrations are down by double digits in the last year. 2009 was the lowest year for vehicle sales in the last 50 years. So, new car registrations, you know, cab fees, obviously, will be off. And 2010 is expected to be slightly better, but I'm not exactly optimistic that's going to come raging back.
Well, I think the principle, Mr. Chair, that I'd like us to consider is, well, we get diminishing returns. The price of the vehicle goes up. Yes, we collect sales tax, but then fewer vehicles are sold, which affects our cab fees detrimentally. So it's a sort of balancing act in there somewhere we may want to consider at some point.
No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're going to have Representative Beard discuss some of the issues, not some of the issues, a quick summary of what's going on with airports, because we deal with airports, and we have a situation where some of the planes are being not registered in the state of Minnesota. They're being domiciled in a neighboring state, and Representative Beard deals with the air portion of our committee, and he's going to just report what's going on in the airport industry.
Well, I won't speak about the entire industry, but specifically about a bill that we've been working on for a couple of years. Bipartisanly, we had constituted the Aviation Revenue Task Force Study Group that I think Senator Jungbauer from the Senate and Representative Dill from the House co-chaired that committee over the last couple of years. We came up with some recommendations. But first, let me give you just a brief overview, and I'll keep this less than 4 minutes and stand for questions. The Minnesota Aeronautics Fund, Airport Fund, is funded primarily from three revenue sources: a tax on fuel, both avgas and jet fuel, which are different. Talk about that in a minute. The registration fees that we pay on airplanes, and we're pretty proud of our registration fees in Minnesota. They're very high and very progressive. And the third thing is the flight line property tax, which because of the way we tax our airplanes on value and size and so on, none of the airlines would ever base an airliner in Minnesota if we taxed them the same way we tax, say, 3M business jets. And so in lieu of that, we have a flight line property tax, which historically has always been the shock absorber. It's adjusted on an annual basis by the Commissioner of Aeronautics, or Director of Aeronautics, we call him now. And that number always floated around a few million dollars a year, depending on how registration fees and fuel tax came into play, how those dollars were doing. One of the things we've done in Minnesota over the years is the more valuable the airplane, the more expensive. It's like we tax it twice. They get to pay 6 and 7/8% sales tax on top of a $40 million purchase, which is a very large number. And then every year we charge them a number close to that to re-register the airplane just for the privilege of basing it here. An airplane like the ones 3M flies, or Xcel Energy, or Target Corporation, or whatever, having them based here is an important economic driver at the airports, because they buy fuel, they rent hangar space, and they employ mechanics, flight attendants, and pilots, professional pilots, to fly those airplanes. In fact, sometimes even the pilots who fly for the regular RUV carriers actually strive to get corporate jobs, because they're considered the cherry job to have. Great flight schedules, great equipment, get to live in Minnesota, and still get weekends off occasionally. It's a pretty nice deal. However, we've created a disincentive for airplanes to be based here, with our annual registration fees being so high. So what we did was we looked at where the crossover point was if we raised, say, the fuel tax, which has never been raised in Minnesota since it was instituted, I believe, in 1947 or 48, maybe raised once in the 50s, and hasn't been adjusted since. And we're among the lowest of the fuel taxes in the nation. So a lot of people come to Minnesota, they won't base their planes here, but they're only happy to fill their tanks and tanker fuel out of Minnesota because it's priced so nicely. However, if we would lower the registration fees, which are very onerous, very high, perhaps we could have airplanes based here and then make that up by raising the fuel tax a couple of cents a gallon. We ran several matrices on how we could make that happen so that it would be somewhat revenue neutral, but we would encourage airplanes to come back to Minnesota and be based, domiciled here, which is good for the employment picture at the airports when we're looking at jobs, and it's good for the economic activity at the airport, which keeps costs down. And there just seem to be some winning percentages there if we could do this and keep it revenue neutral even. Well, while the politicians in the panel were meeting over the last couple of years and discussing these great ideas, our friends at the Minnesota Business Aviation Association came forward with their own proposal, which basically said, where we have the most value are in airplanes that burn kerosene or jet fuel for a living. So they didn't want to monkey with the sales tax or the fuel tax on avgas, 100 low-lead avgas, the kind I burn in my airplane. Instead, we'll just monkey with the price of jet fuel, the kind burned in airliners and most business jets and business airplanes. In exchange for that, we would lower the flight line property tax and the registration fees. The fond hope would be competitive with Illinois and Wisconsin and Iowa. Planes wouldn't be leaving the state to be based in Eau Claire or La Crosse. Instead, they would be based in the Twin Cities or places like that. And so that's what we've been working on. It will keep the airport's fund as whole as we possibly can in a down economy. But at this time, that's the legislation that we're prepared to introduce. It is being prepared to be introduced. And perhaps with that, I can stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions? Lipton Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Beard, for all your work over the years on this issue. I just want to be clear. Are you saying that in this proposal to increase the av fuel tax, it would just apply to commercial and private jet fleets, as opposed to, you know, the more, you know, the smaller, you know, prop plane, single engine, two engine, smaller plane? The proposal, as I understand it from MBAA at this time, is, and I think they did it out of a sense of nobility, because all of their members burn jet fuel in their turboprops or jets. There's two types of fuel. There's gasoline, avgas we call it, and that is on a volume basis, it's a much smaller percentage of the total sales tax, fuel tax that's collected. The people who really burn a lot of gas are the bigger, faster airplanes. They burn a lot of kerosene to go from here to Chicago, for instance, way more than I would burn for avgas. The proposal is only to deal with jet fuel at this time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, so, for example, when the Saab flies the Saab 340, that would not be subject to your increase?
Mr. Chairman, no, it would be, because the Saab 340 burns kerosene.
Okay.
It burns jet fuel. It's a turboprop engine.
So some props do and some don't.
Yeah, correct. Just because it has a propeller doesn't mean it doesn't burn kerosene.
That was the gist of my question.
Now I understand the gist of your need to know.
Rick, and how is it?
Mine is not to the point you're raising, but it does have to do with airports, and so it's just your opinion and others on the committee. And that is commercial aviation in the small airports, and I would particularly think Rochester, St. Cloud, and Duluth. St. Cloud I think the last of their commercial aviation was just discontinued.
Mm-hmm.
We have bonding requests from airports, and the specific one is an expansion of the Duluth terminal this year.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are there any, what's the literature saying about small airports and the likelihood of airlines to continue to serve them?
We'd have to have a brief discussion about the Essential Air Service Program, which was an outcome of the deregulation back in the late 70s, early 80s, when airline prices were deregulated and the market was allowed to adjust to where need and cost and all that stuff. A lot of the smaller airports that were served because the old, between the Interstate Commerce Commission, I believe, and the Civil Aeronautics Board, they told people if they were going to get a franchise to fly from Minneapolis, they'd have to have so many flights a day to Bemidji, for instance, or International Falls. It's the old command and control route system. When that was abolished, of course, there was a stampede to get out of a lot of smaller markets like Thief River Falls and so on and so forth. And so the federal government set up something called the Essential Air Service System, whereby they would open routes like St. Cloud, for instance. I don't know if Rochester, I'm looking for my favorite lobbyist in the back here that knows airlines. I don't know if Rochester's ever been part of the EAS or Duluth, but smaller airports, Mankato had air service at one time. They were part of it. They got actually paid. The government actually paid small airlines to run like the Saab 340s, for instance, International Falls. And they had a formula they had to follow, and then they would make up their losses and pay them a management fee for doing that. That program is under review because of the deficit and the federal government spending so much money keeping Essential Air Service going. Whether or not Rochester, Duluth, or St. Cloud are part of that, well, I'll have to get you the facts on that. But I know the Duluth Terminal, for instance, I think the Duluth Airport stands on its own with its own passenger service and doesn't get EAS payments. So I think it's probably a pretty sure deal there's going to be airline service there for a while yet.
Thank you, Representative. And for the members that are still here, we have a joint meeting the end of January with the Senate. You should be aware of that. And if there are no further questions and no further something to come before the committee, the meeting is adjourned. And thank you for attending.